This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your omito of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Vai minha tristeza e diz a ela que sem ela não pode ser. Diz-lhe numa prece que ela regresse, porque eu não posso mais sofrer.
That's right, I said it, omito. You're listening to Chega de Saudade. Joao Gilberto passed away earlier this month. A father of bossa nova music, an incredibly transformational figure in the music of the late 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. I knew I wanted to do something on Gilberto. There really is only one person to call. You call up the god. You call up Ben Ratliff. OG podcast heads, stand at attention. The king is home. What's good?
Hey, thank you. That's a pretty nice welcome.
I know. We could go now.
That's not bad at all.
No, that's real. It's all real. The love is genuine, and the authority is pure. So, the real talk.
Okay.
So, we're going to get into this Gilberto. All right. We're going to get into it from a historical perspective, but then we're also going to kind of spiral out later on. We're going to talk about what it means to be quiet. We're going to talk about texture. Might talk about ASMR.
Oh, well, you know, above all, the fact that we're doing this, what is it, a week?
About a week and a half, yeah.
May be appropriate for the subject. This is music that takes its time.
Both figuratively, but also literally.
Yeah.
This is not a person who was in a rush.
Yeah. Hastiness does not really pay when you're dealing with bossa nova.
So let's get into a little bio, a little background. So Gilberto died. He was 88, born in 1931. What was the sound of Brazil? Shouts to SOB. Shout to my boy Junior. What was the sound of Brazil that he arrived into in the 50s? Like, what was the challenge that he had to rise up against, in essence?
Well, 40s and 50s Brazilian pop music was either samba-derived or it was Frank Sinatra-derived,
right,
basically. You know, I mean, there was a growing fascination with American crooners, and that dovetailed with a kind of Latin American tradition of the bolero, you know, a kind of deep romantic song, crooners, belters, people with big kinds of voices, you know.
Was it sort of cosmopolitan music or more like street music or a little bit of both?
It was cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was well established that samba, which is an Afro-Brazilian thing, was the music of the country. You know, that was sort of understood on a grand scale. That was the music of the country. The same way that, you know, black bean dishes were the dishes of the country. Mm-hmm. There was a very widely understood notion of Brazilian as a mixed-race samba-identified country, you know? But there were these kind of commercial pop songs with, you know, singers with big voices. And that was more and more on the rise. So that really was what Jean Gilberto was resisting or doing something against. It's not that it's not necessarily that he hated that music. Mm-hmm. In fact,
and you see that later in his life. It seemed like he sort of
he covered lots of songs from that older period. You know, he made a couple of 78 RPM singles in the early 50s, mm-hmm. but that nobody really heard. Mm-hmm. But they do exist. This is like, you know, 7 or 8 years before he became famous.
You think they're going for a lot of money on Discogs?
I don't know if anybody actually owns them.
All right, we're going to, if you on Discogs, you get them early Jean Gilberto records, you let me know what they're going for.
But to hear him in 1951, as opposed to, you know, when he became Jean Gilberto in 1958, is a totally different thing. He wanted to have a big voice. He had a big, big and soft voice.
Right. But there's different kinds of bigness, right?
Yeah.
There's outward-facing bigness,
right,
or like interior bigness, interior magnitude,
right,
and it seemed like that was the direction that he chose,
yeah,
ultimately,
yeah,
in the late 50s. You want to tell the story about his woodshed, which was
there's a great book written by a newspaper journalist named Huey Castro. It's called Bossa Nova. I don't have it with me. The Sound That Changed the World, or something, mm-hmm. whatever. It was translated into English in the late 90s. It was a great service that it was translated into English. It's an interesting book because it's full of anecdotes. I mean, it's nothing but anecdotes, mm-hmm. really, but there's not much back matter.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not sure that there are any end notes or anything like that.
Just stories.
You just have to rely on Huey Castro that he knows his stuff.
And he's getting it right.
Yeah. I've never heard any serious arguments against the veracity of that book, but, you know, who knows? I don't know. But he tells a fantastic story in it, and it's a turning point in the book about when, you know, Jean Gilberto has kind of done this and that, and he has made those records in 51, and he has a strange reputation, and he's kind of an interior guy, and nobody knows what to make of him, and but he's poor, and he's down on his luck, and he doesn't know where to go and what to do. So he retreats to his sister's house in Minas Gerais, in a town called Diamantina. And he spends a lot of time playing a guitar and singing in her bathroom. And he finds the acoustics of the bathroom to be perfect for something that he wants to work on.
I find this very relatable, I have to be honest.
Mm. How so?
I feel like I sometimes need to access my creativity or to access whatever theoretically pure flow of words might come out of me at any time. I need to cut out other distractions. I need to create a kind of pure space.
Yeah.
I have on occasion written in the bathroom. I like sit in the tub. That's
mm-hmm.
happened.
Mm-hmm.
I also
rub-a-dub-dub, man.
I mean, not
the
with
critic is here.
Not with water in it. Jeez.
Oh, not
no,
with water.
No.
You sit in the dry tub.
Sometimes, yeah.
Just kind of
just calm. It's soothing. Just, you know, not I'm not there's no television, there's no email. Like it's just me and the computer. And that's good. My other version of that is if I'm on a train or a plane or something like that, not a subway, but you know, like an Amtrak or a plane, and I'm like locked into a seat I kind of don't want to be locked into, but I'm just kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
And you're just hearing the kind of like ambient white noise of like a plane flying through the sky or a train moving through space. I can focus so intensely on the screen because all the kind of ancillary distractions have mostly been filtered out.
Yeah.
And so when I read this story about him achieving some calm by retreating to the bathroom, I think that was probably partially about the acoustics of the tile in this bathroom and partially about the mental acoustics of being in a space like that. I found that relatable.
Well, it certainly helps if you want to exert a lot of control over,
well, there's that too,
over your sound.
I wouldn't know anything about
and
that.
And your general life.
Yes.
Which I think was true for him.
Petulant.
The funny thing is that, I mean, the story is amazing and it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because later when he would become famous, he was revolutionary in his microphone technique. You know, he had a dedicated microphone for his voice and a dedicated microphone for his guitar, and that was sort of unusual at the time in pop record production. And then later on, he made a spiritually amazing record, fans call the White Album,
mm-hmm. This is in the 70s,
which the mic seems to be even closer, almost as if it's actually like halfway down his throat. Mm-hmm. So like when you listen to it, you have the sensation of actually almost being inside him. And the great paradox of João Gilberto is that he's a person who does not let you get that
yes.
close. I mean, even the sound of his voice is not a sound of, hey, I would like to be friends with
yes.
you. I'm an okay guy. He's not that at all. You know, it's so clear that this is an introverted person who's not going to, he's going to keep a lot for himself.
He sort of begins to work out that style. And then, so we opened with what is, I guess, the first single that was released in that style, even
yes.
though that song was done by a couple of other performers
yes.
prior to him.
Yep.
But his version is the one that people kind of look at and say, well, that's ground zero. That's the bomb.
Yeah. It was taken as the historical thing, the thing that started a movement.
And so what is it? I mean, we hear it, but for those people who may not be familiar with the kind of the intensities of the samba of that era, this is rejecting a lot of that. It's interior, it's pensive.
Rejecting and embracing in a funny way, because what he's doing with his guitar playing, in a sense, is reducing a samba percussion ensemble to just, you know, his thumb and his fingers. A lot of musicians have said that what he's doing with all the with his thumb is essentially being a bass drum, and what he's doing with the other fingers of
right.
his hand is essentially being a tambourine, which is like a small version of what we call a tambourine, and it's kind of high-pitched, and it's where a lot of the more jagged phrasing in samba comes from. You know, a lot of people made fun of the weird sound of his guitar playing, and they called it stammering guitar. But that stammering guitar was just yet another innovation of the history of black music. So what he's doing with his guitar, it comes from Afro-Brazilian music, but it's reduced down weirdly to a kind of essence. And then what he's doing with his voice is a whole other thing.
Let's talk about the voice, because the thing that I found most intriguing, and I went back and read almost every review that the New York Times had ever published about Gilberto, dating back to the 60s,
yeah.
I guess. And almost every critic says a version of the same thing, which is, number one, all these songs sound alike, LOL.
Uh-huh.
But also the sort of inscrutability of, I think, is John Wilson the guy,
yes.
the jazz critic from the 60s?
Yeah.
The first review, he basically is like, it's basically something I would say if I was trying to be mean. I don't know if he was trying to be mean or not, but it was like Gilberto murmurs these songs.
Right.
So there's this thing about rejecting that kind of openness that you talk about.
Yes, it becomes this question of like, does he want us to be here in
right.
the audience? Does he need us?
Mm-hmm.
Who's he doing this for? There's a new Netflix show,
okay.
Brazilian Netflix show that you can watch here with subtitles. Even with dubbing, I think, called The Most Beautiful Thing, Coisa Mais Linda. And it's set in the Bossa Nova era in the late 50s. It's a story of some young women who come together and start a Bossa Nova club. There's a big scene in, I don't know, episode 2, it's early on, where somebody says, whispering is the new thing.
Mm.
Whispering is cool now.
Mm.
Something like that.
It's a vibe.
Yeah. And the funny thing about whispering is that it can be intimate and soothing.
Yeah.
And of course, sensual. But it can also be like, I do and I don't want you to understand what
yeah,
I'm
you're
saying.
Not invited.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not. And then this is the
or
tension.
Or you're semi-invited.
Right. But this is the tension in Gilberto.
Yeah.
So when you came in, you showed me this book. What is the book that you showed me?
Oh, when the Brazilian record industry in the 90s was just like pumping out product, kind of expensively produced records. They're not anymore, obviously. They're also pumping out various kinds of tributes in book form or video form or whatever about the history of Brazilian music. So this is just a really great book of album jackets and album art from the Bossa Nova period. Anyway, so there's a full-size reproduction of João Gilberto's first album, Chega de Saudade. And so describe that picture.
So we disagreed a little bit on this picture. So he's standing there. He's got the wild V-neck sweater, white with the blue trim, the baby blue trim.
Sitting, though, not standing, right?
What if he's standing and leaning on a podium? I don't know.
It could be.
Could be.
Yeah.
You know, but you're only getting him from the chest up.
Yeah.
He's got his right hand. He's leaning on his right hand.
Yeah.
His right cheek on his right hand.
Yeah.
Depending how you look at it, I think it's like a little bit of a sensual stare.
Yeah.
But like a kind of like maybe like proto-French New Wave sensuality.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of that energy. What do you think's happening here?
Slightly bored, slightly disappointed.
Oh, well, certainly the shape of the mouth has some boredom in it.
And slightly, you'll never get to know who I am. I'm giving you a face that may bring you closer to me, but I'm never really going to let you know who I am. Just give it a try.
You find this album accessible and intimate, or you find it cold?
No, it's really intimate.
Yeah, that's how I felt too.
But it seems to be the thing for me, because when a performer is trying too hard to be close to me, I reject it.
Right.
As a listener.
Enrique Iglesias, for example. Shouts to the god Enrique Iglesias.
Oh.
How come you never got on the phone with Ben Ratliff?
It's true. It never happened.
We're going to talk about being stood up at some point later, but Enrique, just let you know, we haven't forgotten.
Anyway, it's a time-tested way of getting over in popular music, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Before we jump into what happened in 62, 63, 64, should we play something off of either the second or the third album? Or are those not as good as this album?
They're all great. I think maybe something that might be good to play, and I forget which of the first three records it's on, is this song, A Felicidade.
Okay.
Because that song gives you an actual literal juxtaposition of the bossa nova whisper with the big, loud, percussive sound of samba, which comes in the choruses. But then for each verse, it's just
he's wrestling it back to the ground.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so A Felicidade.
Felicidade é como a pluma que o vento vai levando pelo ar. Voa tão leve, mas tem a vida breve. Precisa que haja vento sem parar. A felicidade do pobre parece a grande ilusão do carnaval. A gente trabalha o ano inteiro por um momento de sonho pra fazer a fantasia de rei ou de pirata ou jardineira. E tudo se acabar na quarta-feira.
Come the early 60s.
Yeah.
This music is moving fast. When we think about global cosmopolitanism, this music finds its way to America and starts to get incorporated into, refracted through the jazz world or like the sort of standards world. Where is it picking up?
Well, just as Brazilian musicians were very interested in jazz in the 50s, all of a sudden a few American musicians became interested in Brazilian.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that came from a moment when American guitarist Charlie Byrd flew to Brazil for some kind of State Department tour or something and, you know, learned all about the new music and then made
the new beat, right? Isn't that what bossa nova is? The new beat?
The new thing.
The new thing.
Bossa, it doesn't really mean beat.
Okay.
It just means like a hit in the head or something, you know, like like dunk, you know. And so Charlie Byrd made a bossa nova record and then, you know, there was some excitement. And then the big thing that happened was João Gilberto joined forces with Stan Getz.
So this is in 64.
64. But interestingly, bossa nova in Brazil kind of erupted during this brief period when there was a great feeling of progress,
right?
Social and economic progress happening in Brazil during the Kubitschek regime from 1956 to 1961. And all of a sudden, Brazilians felt very modern, and they felt important, and they felt even futuristic.
Yeah.
And by 1964, everything had changed. There was a military coup in 1964. But it was only 1964 when Americans on a large scale were into Brazilian music and projecting these fantasies onto Brazil.
That then no longer existed.
That were 5 years out of date.
Sure.
You know?
Well, that's not that uncommon. I mean, you know, we talk about Western fantasies of non-Western or non-American
sure.
fantasies and non-American cultures. I mean, this
mistranslation.
Yeah, I mean, 5 years is actually not that long to be out of date.
That's true.
Plenty of people are 30 years out of date.
That's true.
So that changed the sound of Brazil, what was happening in Brazil, quite a bit.
Yeah.
But this had already started to remake what's happening in America. So Gets Gilberto,
yeah.
which is that album that comes out in 64.
Yeah.
That album wins Album of the Year at the Grammys.
Yeah.
It opens, I believe, with a fairly indelible song, The Girl from Ipanema.
Yeah.
So let's listen to The Girl from Ipanema.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Porque estou tão sozinho. Porque tudo é tão triste. Beleza que existe. Beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
The Girl from Ipanema is one of those songs that I definitely had heard before I ever heard it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm.
Before I ever really thought about it in any substantive way.
Yeah.
It just was so much in the fabric of who knows what. It could have been a commercial. It could have been a movie soundtrack.
I think it was in TV commercials.
It must have been.
Right?
It feels like, I mean, it feels ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Even for me, generationally, not a part of this world.
Yeah.
I still feel like I instinctively knew that song. I really enjoyed the first of the three solo albums that Gilberto did.
Yeah.
This I don't love quite as much, this
yeah.
album. Some interesting stuff on it. We'll play in a little bit Desafinado.
Yeah.
We'll play that later. Why did this album hit as hard as it did at the time?
Oh, I don't know, because the was record industry wanted it to be a hit.
But was it an appetite for kind of like exoticism or anything like that? Like,
yeah, sure. I guess exoticism, and also it reconfirmed people's ideas of what these things were, both
yeah.
both the jazz saxophone playing and the sound of bossa nova.
Yeah.
It's not one of my favorite records or anything, but I really respect it.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the word undeniable, but to some degree it does feel a little bit undeniable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for sure, I was listening to it as a introverted teenager. When I wasn't listening to Minor Threat, I was listening to
a major threat
to that, you know, Guess Gilberto and Gets a Go-Go, I don't think I ever heard an actual great João Gilberto record.
Till much later.
At the time. Yeah, till much later. And now, as we can talk about later, they're unavailable.
We've had many, many episodes maligning the streaming services, but we could certainly make room in this episode to malign them some more.
Well, it's not even necessarily the fault of the streaming services that the great first three João Gilberto albums are unavailable.
Is this connected to the lawsuit?
It is connected to the lawsuit.
Okay, should we just quickly sidebar with the lawsuit because it's about those first three records? Should we just do a quick detour? So sometime in the 90s maybe or 2000s, he sues... Was it EMI
it's
Brazil?
It's a very complicated story, but as I understand it, when his contract with EMI lapsed at some point in the 80s, he said, okay, I forbid you now to do anything more with my music.
Right.
But they did anyway. They released a remastered version of his first three albums together on a CD.
Taylor Swift, take note.
Yeah. And he didn't like the job that they did with the remastering.
Wow.
He said that his music became banalized. There was a banalization of his music. He sued and I believe was not successful, but then he sued again and was successful. And the success, I believe, the legal language changed a little bit and the grounds for the suit changed such that what he was protesting was that EMI had his morality.
Yeah, his moral right to his moral ownership.
His moral, yes, and his moral presence in the music. Maybe?
Plausible. Completely plausible.
Anyway,
that's what I tell Karen every time she changes something in one of my stories.
Oh, really?
I'm like, my moral authority.
There's a moral argument.
Yes, there's a moral authority. You have to put the comma back.
Anyway, he won. But I don't think anything really great came of it.
Who has the masters?
I believe the masters went back to him, but there hasn't been another good reissue of his important work. It's not on the market. You can't find it.
Well, it's hiding. It's hiding on YouTube.
It is hiding on YouTube, and it's actually also hiding on Spotify under differently named packages.
Ooh, and sneaky.
And in audio iterations that João Gilberto would hate for you to be listening to. But look, it's there. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, I listened to the transistor radio.
That's
and
right.
I still got some thrills.
That's
that
right.
Way.
And also, so as you are listening to the subpar versions on streaming services and thinking about how you are violating João Gilberto's morality.
Yeah, his morality.
In so doing, I hope that you are at least enjoying the version of him that is there.
There's a lot.
As you are doing him harm.
There's still a lot to enjoy.
Okay. Let's get back to the 60s.
Yeah.
I have an unpopular opinion or feeling.
Yeah.
Not about Gilberto specifically, but about Bossa Nova. And I think I've largely arrived at this terrible take because my earliest exposure to Bossa Nova was basically through like commercials and terrible compilations that I used to get mailed in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, like Bossa Nova Sexy Volume 4.
I can see those covers.
Yeah, you
it
know.
It was generally a cocktail.
Oh, hell yeah.
A female hand.
It was in sort of like an olive, like there was like a sort of like a light olive green backdrop,
yes.
But like the dress of the woman was like fuchsia and teal.
There were some fabrics on display.
No doubt. So that's my entry point.
Mm.
Not the best entry point, you know, so I'm missing something,
yeah.
but I have an unpopular take based on that, which is that Bossa Nova got contrived very quickly.
Yeah.
And when I was listening back to a lot of these records, and not being a person who can insert myself into the cultural moment and say, oh, well, how radical was this in 1958 or 61?
Yeah.
What it reminded me a lot of, when drum and bass went from kind of like early rough stuff to like the late 90s and all of a sudden it's in like car commercials and
right.
like you would go to like one of the high streets in London and go to some store, you go to like Harvey Nichols and they'd be playing like a light, you know, like LTJ Bookham or something.
Yeah.
Now, no knock on LTJ Bookham, who's quite good, but there's just like a lot of drum and bass with the feeling squeezed out.
Yeah.
That happened pretty quickly. It happened certainly within 10 years, maybe within fewer than 10 years. That's how Bossa Nova looks in the rear view.
Mm-hmm.
How true is that to what actually was happening at the time.
Well, you're just describing the normal process of capitalism.
Oh, sure.
Doesn't that happen with most artistic movements?
I do think that others have held on longer or fought more aggressively.
Well, maybe it happened so quickly because there was so much excitement about it. There was so much hope around it. Why was there so much hope? That's a really complicated question. Mm-hmm. And it probably has to do with economic aspects, racial dynamics, the business dynamics of the record business. I mean, you know, look, we shouldn't overlook the fact that this is an Afro-Brazilian derived music in which the pace setters, many of them were white people.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people who ran record companies, say, that was very attractive.
Oh, sure.
You know, were there great black bossa nova artists who were sidelined? Yes, there were. Elijah Costa is one. There's a lot of, you know, there's like, if you wanted to do a kind of, you know, through the looking glass alternate timeline of Brazilian music in which some musicians were less popular and other musicians were more, yeah, you could rewrite the whole thing. But you're asking, is this an unfair characterization that bossa nova became reduced so horribly?
Yes.
It did.
So quickly.
It did.
Okay.
Me, myself, I have very little use for stuff that passes as bossa nova after about, you know, 60, 61.
Yeah, right. No, that's how it feels from a distance. Yeah. But I just didn't know if I was reading it wrong because it all is fuzzy to me.
Right.
You know? I didn't know if I was too far removed from the kind of center narrative that I couldn't see it clearly.
Right. You know, there's a lot of interesting intellectual discourse around bossa nova. And one of the main voices in that discourse has always been Caetano Veloso, yes, the singer-songwriter, who is a little younger than Jorge Gilberto. Mm-hmm. So he came about two micro-genres later, two micro-movements later, and was associated with the tropicalist movement. Mm-hmm. In the mid-60s and after. But for him, Jorge Gilberto is almost like a spiritual figure, a spiritual, I don't know, guiding light, you know? I think because he was original and he had integrity and would not be reduced. And
like a bulwark against something.
Yeah.
Many things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's talked about this in one way or another for a long time. But more recently, he made a song. I think it was in 2012, called A Bossa Nova e Foda. That's a rude word in Portuguese.
That's okay. On podcasts, you can say rude words.
Which
in any language.
Basically means bossa nova is rugged. Bossa nova is like
brolic.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah, tough.
You want to go outside?
Yeah.
You want to step outside with bossa nova?
Exactly.
That's okay.
That's the idea.
Right. Bossa nova will beat you up.
Exactly.
Okay.
Quem terá tido essa fazenda de arais? Fitas cassete, uma ergométrica, os restos de rabada. Lá fora o mundo ainda se torce para encarar a equação. Pura invenção, dança da moda. A bossa nova é foda. Magno instrumento grego antigo diz que quando chegares aqui, que é um dom que muito homem não tem, que é a influência do jazz. E tanto faz se o bardo judeu romântico de Minnesota, porqueiro eu meu reconhece de volta a Ítaca. A nossa vida nunca mais será igual. Samba de roda, o carnaval, Rio São Francisco, Rio de Janeiro, Canavial, a bossa nova é foda.
In this highly poetic song, in which the figure of Jorge Gilberto is kind of the central figure, he makes references to Brazilian mixed martial arts fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And the word foda is a kind of term of respect and admiration used around mixed martial arts and also maybe in certain kinds of heavy rock music. You get the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
at the time when he wrote the song, he was thinking about one of the very rare interviews João Gilberto had given in the 70s to a Brazilian journalist named Tariq de Souza, where João Gilberto says, you know, a lot of people think that bossa nova is all about, you know, softness and gentleness and something. And he's like, they're wrong. Because, you know, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put voice inside guitar patterns with the force of a karate blow. And so Caetano, being in the counterintuition business, like you and I,
yeah, it's true
he's
story.
Kind of a born critic, Caetano Veloso. He loved this idea, you know, like, no, people have it wrong. Bossa nova is not about softness and gentleness. It's about decisiveness. It's about the force of a revelation that punches you between the eyes, basically.
Yeah, I think that's fair based on what I've listened to.
Yeah.
And also based on many of the descriptions of the live performances.
Yeah.
That he played Carnegie a couple times. You wrote about it one time. We should talk also about these records in the 70s. He moved to America. These records in the 70s. I want to quote from the central key tome, Every Song Ever by Ben Ratliff, which we got to bring out. We had to bring out because there's some key Gilberto stuff on here. So you're talking about that Wendy Carlos record, Wendy Carlos produced record. 73.
Engineered it.
Wendy Carlos engineered record. 73, self-titled. Here's a good paragraph. It's not specifically about the record, but it's the why.
Okay.
Intimacy is a reaction against all that is normal and acceptable in performance. It is the rhetoric of speaking only to one person as opposed to thousands. And this, when you say punch between the eyes, this is what that is to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's to you. It's not to all y'all, it's to you. At its best, it commands by withdrawing. It can sound selfish, a self-limiting of potential, or it can sound generous as the most or best that a shy person can muster. It draws you inside the performer's instrument or respiratory system.
Mm-hmm.
Let's play Falsa Baiana.
Yeah.
Baiana que entra no samba só fica parada, não canta no samba, não pole nem nada, não sabe deixar a mocidade louca. Baiana é aquela que entra no samba de qualquer maneira, que mexe, remexe, dá nó nas cadeiras e deixa a moçada com água na boca. Baiana que entra no samba só fica parada, não canta no samba, não pole nem nada, não sabe deixar. Aquela que entra no samba de qualquer maneira, que mexe, remexe, dá nó nas cadeiras e deixa a moçada com água na boca. A falsa baiana quando entra no samba.
So that is from the 73 self-titled record. Talk about the connection between recording technique and oral texture going on here.
Basically, that record is just him, voice and guitar, although there's also a percussionist guy named Sonny Carr, a New Yorker, a sort of like part-time musician that João Gilberto got to know. And what Wendy Carlos, as the engineer, was able to do was to get the mic really close to him. So I don't know what – I mean, I would love to see a picture of him in the studio.
It's an endoscopy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It is like an endoscopic kind of recording. Yeah. And also, it's a weird kind of time-warping record because some of the songs just go on and on and on. And, you know, this is from somebody who made great short records.
Yeah.
Chega de Saudade is, I think, a minute and 59 seconds long.
Yeah.
But some of the tracks on the White Album go on for a while. Notably, the song Unju, which is not a word. Some have said that it's João Gilberto's approximation of like a bird sound. And unju is the only word. And he just sings it over and over.
Thank you.
just to get back to the kind of punch between the eyes concept, it's a really entrancing and weird song. And this is where, like, you know, Caetano's notion of Jorge Gilberto as a mixed martial arts fighter is great. And that will be Caetano's idea. Mm-hmm. That's his property. I tend to think about Jorge Gilberto as almost like a metal god. You know, just like, you know, like,
yeah,
an ideal form of a metal god, mm-hmm. a kind of god of darkness. You will never get to know this person. He is in touch with something a little bit supernatural, yeah. but he's not going to spell it out for you.
Right.
The first rule of Jorge Gilberto is we don't talk about Jorge Gilberto, you know, that kind of thing.
But is the supernatural the same as the primal? I don't, and this is a question, because
I see what you're saying.
Because one of the things in these limited interviews yeah. that he did, when I was looking back at these interviews, a thing that came up twice was him talking about wanting to get back to childhood,
yeah.
to being a boy,
yeah,
to sort of like some proto state.
Because when he got older, he learned too much.
Yeah.
And he would like to know less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's what the music he's trying to reflect. He's trying to, not to, you know, you used the word earlier, reduced. And obviously I was thinking about Rick Rubin, but he's trying to reduce.
I think in this way, and you're absolutely right, what he was doing was maybe more on a primal level than mm-hmm. a supernatural level. And he certainly, you know, when he did talk, I don't know about him talking about spirituality or the mm-hmm. supernatural.
I mean, yeah, it could be both. I mean, you know, I'm not even proposing that they're separate.
Yeah.
That somehow they might be stitched together, perhaps.
But I would place him in the company of other notable mid-century undersharers. And I'm talking about artists like Francis Bacon mm-hmm. and Samuel Beckett and Merce Cunningham, mm. who were averse to the idea that everything has to be a story.
Yeah.
They weren't going to spell out the story for you. Mm-hmm. Instead, they preferred to deliver their insight like a punch between your eyes.
Yeah.
They resisted typical narrative as story or as arc or whatever. And I guess I see Jorge Gilberto kind of in alignment with that sort of thing. And it certainly also spilled into his actual physical, material, personal life, in which he did not talk to reporters. And in fact, you know, for the last 10 years or more of his life, barely opened the door.
There are two different pathways in which we learn about what Gilberto was like. One are these interviews, which are like a little bit mystical, a little bit abstract, but also very infrequent. And the other are the sort of documents of his live performances,
yeah.
which are not just recordings, but critic reviews.
Mm-hmm.
In every review that I read of a Gilberto live performance, he's always doesn't look at people, doesn't speak outside of playing songs, or speaks very little, if at all, doesn't give anything.
Yeah, basically reserved and shy, unless he felt compromised, unless he didn't like the sound system mm-hmm. or he was having some kind of technical trouble, in which case he would speak up and in some cases be a little rude to an audience. There was a famous concert he gave. It was like the inaugural concert of a fancy new concert hall. I forget whether it was in Rio or Sao Paulo, maybe 2000. No. It was like late 90s. He was fiddling with his sound, with his microphones, with his guitar, whatever. He was taking his time. The audience was getting restless and going a little crazy, and they started booing. And he said to them, "Boos from drunks don't count." And then he like stuck out his tongue and so like
that's gonna be my new Twitter bio.
Yeah,
just FYI.
Yeah, so he could give back. You know, he could
step outside.
He could hit
with bossa nova. Want it with bossa nova?
He could hit back.
So he was like that in his music and also in his personal life.
Perhaps
it seems that way. You want to tell the story about you trying to interview him
in 2000? I seemed to have the opportunity to interview him, and I was very excited about it.
Was it in connection to a particular thing, or?
No, it was through the actions of a well-placed intermediary who—
The plug.
Who knew him and was going to make it happen. And the intermediary called me one night and said, "Ben, here's his number. Call him. He's waiting for your call. So I called him.
Were you in New York?
Yeah, I was in New York. Okay, right. So I called him, and he picked up, and we had a nice chat. And I said, look, I'm going to be there. How about if I come there, you know, in 2 weeks or something like that? I gave a date, a time, et cetera. Yeah. And he said, that's fine. It's going to work. So I flew to Rio, and he apologized through the intermediary once I was there that it's really too bad that this interview isn't going to happen.
Did you have a good time in Rio, though?
Yeah. You know, it was great. I mean, the New York Times, this was during the John Rockwell era of arts and leisure. Sure. So I had a big arts and leisure story, you know,
that
I was looking forward to writing. You know, it's like Garbo Speaks. And Rockwell was very excited about it. And I felt terrible when it fell through.
Yeah,
I didn't
sure.
really have too much else planned. When I got back, Rockwell was sort of sweetly understanding. You know, he was like, it doesn't look good. I have to tell you that it doesn't look good when something like this happens.
I mean, sure.
He's right.
He's right. But it's also bigger than you.
Yeah. We're dealing with something that is hard to manage.
I thought that I had had the best getting stood up story.
What was that?
When I used to write for XXL, I went to Miami to interview Ghostface.
Yeah.
Probably on the second solo record.
Right.
Maybe the third. I waited in the lobby of his very fancy apartment building for 2 days, only to find out at the end of the
second. Like sort of 9 to 5?
I'm like 10 to 10.
10 to 10.
Yeah. Only to be told at the end of the second day that he was not at home.
Wow.
His manager at the time.
And never had been.
No, had never been. Maybe I didn't say 10 to 10 because I do remember distinctly one of those nights calling my editor and be like, I'm going to the steakhouse and I'm getting a steak and you're paying for it.
Yeah.
So maybe I left early one of those nights. Mm-hmm. And so I had to leave Miami and then go back a week and a half later where on the second day of that trip, he did grant me an audience and talked. It was an amazing, I mean, tremendous, tremendous Ghostface interview. Mm. But I had spent an entire trip just in his lobby.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you win.
Wow. But it's amazing that he came through.
He did come through. I mean, you know, I think Gilberto seemed to know that he was letting you down. I'm not sure that Ghostface knew he was letting me down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you didn't hold it against him.
No, actually, you know, it just...
You found it charming.
Well, it contributed to Umitu.
Hell yeah.
You know? But João Gilberto existed as a tantalizing absence in Brazilian cultural life for about 30 years, you know?
He did not record a lot of records. You sort of point this out.
Yeah.
10 studio albums in...
Sounds about right.
5 decades, give or take?
Sounds about right.
There's other lives and yada, yada, yada. But in terms of... And he wasn't a writer. Not really.
A songwriter.
Yeah.
No, not really.
Yeah.
No, not really.
The type of thing that we usually sort of ascribe, talk about mystical stuff.
I think that when you talk about, you know, well, was he a... He wasn't much of a songwriter, was he? I think you immediately have to start talking about, well, what is a song?
Yeah, yeah.
And what is
writing?
What is writing? And what is a musical work?
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
But I mean...
I mean by Grammy rules. You know,
Sure.
The only important ones.
Sure.
Yeah.
At least 2 novels were written about him, sort of using him as a fictional character. Sure. Yeah. And toward the end of his life, a French filmmaker did a film based on a German guy's book called like Where is João Gilberto or something, and it's all about, you know, the person walking around Rio trying to find traces of him and, you know, interview his barber and stuff like that.
João Gilberto has a cold.
Yeah. The end of his life was just very, very withdrawn, and even those who were close to him weren't let in.
There was some suggestion in some of the reports about maybe financial troubles or things of that nature. Do we know anything about that?
I know so little about it because whatever the truth is, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, did the EMI money ever get to him? I'm not sure that it did.
Yeah.
And there might have been, you know, intra-family squabbles that made everything complicated. He was going to be given an honorary doctorate by Columbia.
Okay.
This was something that I knew a little bit about because I know the guy who who really made it happen at Columbia. And it really looked like Zsa was going to fly to New York. It got very close, and then it didn't happen. The story I have heard is that he actually got to the airport, but it didn't happen. So he got a haircut for the occasion as well.
Wow.
But it didn't.
So you know, well, he was serious.
But it did not happen.
You know he was serious.
Yeah.
Can we talk before we go about quiet?
Mm. Yeah.
And whisper.
In what way?
So, okay. When I was listening to a bunch of these Gilberto records, and I could hear, probably because of the recording technique, you sort of, we made a joke about the endoscopic recording on that 73 album. You really hear the playing of the guitar. And by playing, I don't mean the notes. I mean like the physicality of like a hand hitting a string.
Yeah.
You really hear that on some of these records. And it got me thinking a lot about ASMR.
Mm-hmm.
And the appeal of being drawn in to this, it's almost pre-musical. The most appealing things about the Gilberto records for me was that kind of magnetism of physicality and intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what a lot of kids are kind of reacting to with ASMR, and
mm-hmm.
especially in a kind of like hyper trafficked, hyper social media, that like to have something that's whoosh.
I guess, yeah, it's a great, what you're saying is a great idea. And I think maybe listening to the most intimate of the Zsa Gilberto records is similar to ASMR mm-hmm. videos in that it gets you out of yourself and also within yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, listening to those records also could be a sort of mirror neuron experience.
What's that?
Well, it's the theory, probably debunked by real scientists, I don't know, but that when you hear, or especially when you watch somebody do something fascinating, you have neurons within yourself that fire correspondingly, almost as if you're doing the thing yourself.
Huh, interesting.
So I guess one of the sensations you can have when you're listening, let's say, to the self-titled White Album by Zsa Gilberto is almost that you're making the music yourself.
Huh.
Or at the very least, that the sound is somehow inside of you.
Yeah, you're channeling it in a way. It's sort of like erupting through you, kind of. Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that.
Which I guess is a little different from the, you know, nice accepted commercial version of intimacy and whispered confidences and stuff. It's a little deeper and darker and weirder.
But also, I mean, it's really what are we talking about when we talk about intimacy? Are we talking about a thing that another person grants you? Or are we talking about a thing that you allow yourself to experience, that you drop down all of your outer defenses, your pretensions, and allow yourself to embody?
Yeah.
The intimacy is not a gift from another person. The intimacy is, it's your internal processing of it. Maybe that's it.
The intimacy is a choice of the beholder?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, it's not a thing that's gifted to you.
Uh-huh.
It's a thing that you allow.
Yeah. Hmm. Could be.
I don't know. It really...
ASMR. Are you going to link to some ASMR videos on the page?
I will say this. One of the real frustrating things about ASMR singing is a lot of it is just whisper singing. That's not that interesting to me.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in the ASMR that's like...
Right, sure. Isn't the theory about SoundCloud, hip-hop, and all that kind of thing in recent times that it has become more intimate because of the way people are listening to it? I don't know, just like the... Maybe what we're talking about is something that goes far more back than SoundCloud rap, but, you know, like the earbud revolution or something. Isn't it theorized that music has become more intimate
I think so.
Because of that?
I do think that that's real.
Uh-huh.
I also think that I know I, as a person, feel intensely distracted at all times. This is something I've always admired about you, is I don't think like you get distracted. But I feel intensely distracted at all times. And there is something jolting about being afforded the opportunity to not be distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And then taking that opportunity.
Hmm.
That, to me, That's radical. That's wild.
Is it a sort of, I didn't know how much I needed this kind of sensation?
It's not even that I needed it. It's almost, I did not know that my body / mind / emotions even vibrated on this frequency.
Right.
It's so buried.
Right.
It's so 1.0.
Right.
You know, it's 0.0.
I like how we're ending up with sensations and frequencies and vibrations.
That's really what this stuff made me think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why with the ASMR stuff, like I said, the singing, it gets a little cutesy because it's like singing a Justin Bieber song. I'm just singing it this way.
Mm-hmm. What's the ultimate commercial ASMR vocal? Is it the Fireflies song?
Oh, that's interesting. That Owl City record?
Yeah. That's kind of definitely pre-ASMR, but was it the harbinger of these sensations? That's a creepy record.
I detest that record.
Mm.
What's up with Owl City?
I don't know. Where is he?
He'd probably do really well on YouTube, to be honest, if he was doing ASMR videos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's probably doing stuff under a different name.
Yeah, if I was him, I would be for sure. Should we go out with Desafinado?
Totally.
We're going to wake you guys back up. This is off the Getz Gilberto record, right?
Okay.
This is Desafinado.
Saiba que isto em mim provoca imensa dor. Só privilegiados têm ouvido igual ao seu. Eu possuo apenas o que Deus me deu.
That is our show, to which I can say,
hey, John, I want to say that it's so nice to see you again.
It's such a gift that you're here.
Even though we're separated by microphones and 5 feet of physical space, I feel very close to you in a spiritual way.
I feel very close to you even when you're not here, to be honest, but I'm grateful that you're here.
Yeah.
A reunion is long overdue.
Yeah.
Thank you to Ben for coming today. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me the songs that sound like they were recorded in your larynx at podcastnytimes.com. And subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, the podcast app, yada, yada, yada. Our producers this week are Dan Powell in the room and Pedro Rosado out in the ether from Headstepper Media. And we will be back next week.
Assim do meu amor, ele é o maior que você pode encontrar, viu? Você com a sua música esqueceu o principal, que no peito dos desafinados, no fundo do peito bate calado, no peito dos desafinados também bate um coração.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.